It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Are individual rights more important than the common good? It's a question American society has struggled with since the very founding of our country, and it still provides the backdrop for many of our modern political debates. Take healthcare, for example. There are those who say the common good is the government ensuring coverage for all, even if it means higher taxes for some. But others say that's an infringement on individual rights to enjoy the fruits of their labors without excessive taxation. Another example, the Patriot Act, and the many arguments over whether more government surveillance improves public safety or jeopardizes cherished principles of liberty. But this question of individual rights and common goods isn't just about politics. It shows up in other realms as well. For example, when you talk about the environment, does my desire for the convenience and comfort of a minivan outweigh the fact that these vehicles get poor gas mileage and contribute more to global warming? And the question also comes up in classic moral dilemmas, as in, if your lifeboat's sinking because it has too many people, whose individual right to stay in that boat do you reject in the interest of everyone else surviving? Today in The Exchange, our monthly philosophy series, The Socrates Exchange, is back. And the question we're pondering with you this hour is, are individual rights more important than the common good? Let's hear from you. We'll take lots of your calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. My co-host for this month's Socrates Exchange is Nick Smith. He is a professor of philosophy at UNH. He's an advisor to UNH's Socrates Society and project advisor to us here on the Socrates Exchange. And Nick Smith, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and before we get started with the callers, Nick, just remind us of how the Socrates Exchange programs are run, because they are different from our normal exchange programs.
Unlike other programs where listeners call in and sort of look for the expert to answer the question, we're going to be just pushing harder on the questions and seeing where these questions take us. So the callers stay on the air, engage in the conversation, and see how far down this path we can get.
So a reminder again, when you call 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, don't just hang up. Once you say your bit, Nick is going to engage with you a little bit in that Socratic dialogue. Just remind us of how that goes, Nick, with the callers.
Well, the callers will call in, and especially with a topic like this, people tend to have rather heated and sometimes almost fundamentalist beliefs about whether the common good or individual rights are more fundamental. And my role is to push on those beliefs a bit to get us thinking about the big underlying issues that we may in our ordinary lives be blind to. And once we take a hard look at them, things tend to get more complicated than they might seem at first glance. So our hope is that we all become a little bit more sophisticated, a bit smarter, a bit wiser in these profoundly important questions.
You know, Nick, when this question comes up, and you alluded to this, it often gets very political. The question does come up in other realms as well. But just remind us, Nick, of how we see this question around us all the time, every day, in our headlines about the political debates of our time.
Initially, when this question is framed, it's often thought in terms of political issues, such as you mentioned earlier. Should we sort of infringe on my individual rights by taking a portion of my income to, say, fund public schools or public health care? But in addition to that public aspect of the question, there's the moral aspect, meaning, you know, we know that a substantial portion of the world's population suffers from deep, debilitating poverty. Do I have some kind of individual responsibility to give up a bit of my wealth to support the common good? Is there a kind of a moral charge that I need to meet? And there's also what we might think of as a social or even a sociological aspect of this question regarding whether we have become, say, Americans in 2009, not only individualistic but excessively individualistic, to the point that we almost seem like a greedy culture, and whether there's any truth to that notion that we place so much value on individual rights that it affects our culture, our values, our beliefs, and our personality.
You know, and this is especially salient here in the Live Free or Die state, isn't it, Nick?
Precisely.
Again, the number is 1-800 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is the Socrates Exchange today. Again, a little different from our regular program. Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Nick, we received a lot of postings on our website, nhpr.org, on this question before the program, and we'll share some of those postings with you later today. We'll start taking your calls, too, in just a moment, but I want to first explore this topic a little bit more in the political sense, Nick. As you said, it's pretty sharply contrasted in the political realm, and nowhere more than when you're comparing the ideas of a socialist versus a libertarian. Exchange executive producer Keith Shields spoke with one of each.
My name is David Knutinen, and I've been an activist with Democratic Socialists of America since the mid-80s. And I'm currently a member of the National Political Committee, and I'm also a member of the local Boston Executive Board. Socialists probably have worked more for human rights than possibly any other group. I mean, we've been doing this for 200 years. But the concept of rights is not really central to our way of thinking in the way that I believe it is, for example, to a libertarians. But my sense from what I've read is that libertarians tend to start with rights. And socialists don't place any rights prior to society. We think society defines rights. We don't really have any sense that people have rights other than what's socially defined. And since people define the rights, people have the right to limit the rights and think about how the rights apply, when they apply, how far they go.
My name is Rich Tomaso. I am the chair of the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire. Libertarianism is grounded on the idea of individual rights. So if everyone abides by these principles, then society as a whole, i.e. the common good, greatly benefits. Our default position is that our individual rights matter more than some abstract notion of the common good. The difference between a libertarian philosophy and a socialist philosophy is pretty stark. I mean, the socialist assumes that the group is dominant versus the libertarian point of view, which is the individual is the most important. The libertarians believe if you apply any sort of scrutiny or logic to this collectivist thinking, it falls apart because groups are made up of individuals. And so if the individual doesn't have any rights, how can the group have rights? Your rights don't come from your associations. They come from the fact that you're a human being. And the whole concept of collective rights or group rights, especially in America, it just falls apart under our system that we believe in equal justice and due process and the sovereignty of the individual.
One place that socialists and libertarians differ is the right of property. Socialists, in common with our way of thinking about everything is socially defined, we think the whole question of individual property is a little bit problematic. I mean, libertarians say, I made this, I earned this, this is mine. We think that isolating a certain part of human production and saying, this is the part that I produced and nobody else contributed to this, is at the very least extremely difficult and problematic. I mean, if nothing else, we're all born as helpless infants. We have to be raised and taught and nurtured. We learn the technology of our society, the skills that we then later apply to our work. So socialists normally will say that all wealth is socially produced. And trying to divide it into little tiny personal parcels the way libertarians prefer to do doesn't make much sense to us.
The libertarian philosophy on property rights comes from the idea of self-ownership. You know, you own your own body and you own the fruits of your labor. And necessarily private property is a result of that. With common or communal property, you run into the problem of the tragedy of the commons, where if everyone thinks everybody owns it or nobody owns it, then no one takes care of it. So if you have the idea of I own something and I own the fruits of my labor and I own property, then I can reap the benefits of owning that property and therefore I gain prosperity and society as a whole gets better.
There are always going to be disagreements in society as to the best way to go after the common good, and some of us are going to feel that our common good is different than that guy's common good. The way to decide whether one person's common good is the right view or another person's view of the common good is the right view is through dialogue, through debate, and then hopefully we convince each other and reach consensus or at least compromise. If that's not possible, then we take a vote and somebody's going to go away unhappy. But, you know, that's what democracy is all about. The rights are really defined by society, and the democratic process is the way to negotiate between different people's conception of those rights.
We have a constitutional republic. Contrary to what a lot of politicians say, we do not live in a democracy. We have a democratic system, but we have a republic, which is a rule of law and respect for minority rights. Under a pure democracy, you have the tyranny of the majority, where 51% can decide the fate of the other 49%. And a lot of people on the more collectivist socialist side seem to love the idea of democracy, because if you have the biggest group, you win. And libertarians generally respect what we have as a republic and a constitutional system. Look at the Bill of Rights. If you really read the Bill of Rights, it's actually a list of restrictions on the government. Congress shall make no law. The right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And then you have the Ninth and Tenth Amendment, which essentially are these umbrella clauses that say, we may not have listed all these rights, but you still have them. And in the case of the federal government, a lot of that power actually belongs properly in the states of the people, and we only have our enumerated rights. So that's, in a sense, a very libertarian document.
Those conversations were produced by Exchange executive producer Keith Shields and Nick Smith. Let's go to our callers now. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. First up is Teresa in Wilton. Teresa, you're on the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thank you. I was just, when I was looking at kindergarten, I had one kindergarten that I looked at that I would have liked to send my child to, that they had a child or a few children in their classroom that had peanut allergies, and therefore there would be peanut-free foods that I would have to bring for my or send with my child for lunch. And because it's a private school, I can understand you having that rule. But going into first grade now, some of the public schools, I understand, they separate the peanut children, or they ask that you not bring birthday cupcakes that are processed using peanuts or just cut them out completely. I haven't really thought this one through, but it doesn't seem fair to me that something that only a few children have are affecting a larger group of people.
Well, Teresa, stay on with us. We have to go to a short break, but this is an issue that comes up a lot, Nick. Here's her individual right to send peanut-included goods to classes infringed by the common good ideal because a couple kids have allergies. It's a question that comes up a lot. Teresa, stay on the line. We'll be right back with the Socrates Exchange.
It's 9:19. Good morning. Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from UR members and GDS Associates, engineers and consultants, offering homeowners and businesses energy-efficient audits and advice on renewable energy. Online at gdsassociates.com/NH. From Centrix Bank, meeting business needs throughout New Hampshire today and tomorrow, online at centrixbank.com. And Grapponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grapponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at grapponi.com. More of the Socrates Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Unemployment, the Dow over 10,000, and CEO pay. New Hampshire weather for today, sunshine, high temperatures, mid-40s North Country, mid-50s South. Tonight, partly cloudy in most of the state, mostly cloudy in the North Country. Lows tonight, mid-20s North, mid-30s in the South. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is the Socrates Exchange today, where once a month we examine one question using the Socratic method of asking more questions and more questions. This month on the Socrates Exchange, we're asking, are individual rights more important than the common good? The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Nick Smith is my co-host for the hour. And Nick, just before the break, we were talking with Teresa, who, she's still with us, is a little frustrated that she has to bend over backwards to find peanut-free goods to send to her child's kindergarten.
Yes, this is a profound insight, thinking about the peanut issue recently is just, I think, the very recent example of the way we've thought about this, often most recently in terms of disabilities, right? There was this long conversation of, you know, why should I have to make my business or my school accessible to the disabled when there are so few of these individuals compared to the collective? Why should I invest the school's budget on ramps instead of computers or something like that would benefit the whole community? But Teresa, this kind of gets us into issues generally regarding health and well-being, sort of the common good. And when we think about the individual right of, say, you know, your child to bring a peanut butter and jelly sandwich versus the potentially life-threatening allergy that another child in the classroom might have, literally it could be life and death issue, versus versus the pleasure of, say, having a peanut butter sandwich rather than a soy nut and jelly sandwich. Do you think your child's right to have that bit of, say, taste preference in peanut butter over soy nut is more important than that child's potential right to be alive?
Well, I guess I would reverse the question and say no, but maybe there's another place that child should be.
So perhaps you think that we should isolate children with peanut allergies, sort of in the same way that we might isolate children with disabilities?
When it comes to lunchtime, perhaps, or, yeah, maybe it's a severe enough disability. If it's that life-threatening, maybe it is a severe enough disability that they should be isolated.
Do you feel comfortable how this sort of exchange starts to drift you towards the notion of separate but equal, right? That some children get to sit at one lunch table, and then the children with the special needs or the disabilities get sort of put somewhere else, whether it's a different table or a different school, right? The idea of the equality of the children to eat together and socialize together is rather important. Are you comfortable still that your child's right to enjoy peanut butter is more important than that child's right to have a fully rich experience in school?
Yes.
Good. I mean,
separate but equal, they're not equal. There are people with disabilities who cannot take the stairs, and so they do have to have another route.
Mm-hmm.
To give an extreme example, someone who might live in a bubble, there are many things that they cannot do.
Well, Teresa, it's tough questions. It does come up a lot. It came up a lot with the Americans with Disabilities Act, as you mentioned. And Teresa's right. It's coming up in kindergartens and preschools around the country. Our phone number here in the Socrates Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And Teresa, thanks a lot for being first up on the air with us today. Next up is Nanette in Franconia. Hi, Nanette. Go ahead. You're on the Socrates Exchange.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Sure can, Nanette. Go ahead.
I was listening to your socialist versus your libertarian viewpoint, and I didn't quite follow the libertarian's view of the abstract idea of society, because to me, the idea of individual rights is an abstract one, because individual rights are only important as they are impacted or in relationship to the group. If one man is an island, what's the idea of a right? There's no one. Rights are given. They're bargains. They're balancing between individuals, or in the larger sense, between an individual and a group. So there's no concept of rights outside of the group. So whoever said that, which I think is the socialist, I guess I fall down on that side of the equation.
Well, stay with us, Nanette. Go ahead,
okay.
Nick Smith.
Good. This is an interesting thing to pull on a bit, because in part what we're talking about here is the burden of proof, we might call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the libertarian, they have these abstract ideals of individual rights. For the socialist, you have sort of an abstract idea of the common good, both of which are rather abstract. If you're erring towards a belief in the common good, can you take a swing at defining what you mean by that?
Well, the common good is, what I mean by the concept of the common good, I think it has to be a balance of between the what's more important. Like the previous caller, to me, it's obvious to me that the small inconvenience of someone having to not have peanuts at school versus the potential life-threatening event of a person getting peanuts by mistake, that there's really no question that you have to, as a group, because we live in a society where we have to deal with each other, that we have to make these small compromises, and we can balance the life and liberty over property, over convenience, over other lesser important rights.
Can I ask you then, if that's how you understand this balance and series of compromises, if that's what you mean by the common good, can you tell me who belongs in that population of the common good? Are we talking about just
everyone,
just your family, the United States, the global, sort of every human alive today, every human alive forever?
Well, that gets to the area of concern versus area of impact. I mean, we can be concerned about the whole world, but I think we have to focus on something a little more concrete. So if we try in our circles, like the school in her case, or in our communities, and at the different governmental levels, like our town, and then when we have as a community our Congress, where the concern is more widespread, it's the U.S., and then we have our State Department, and the other part of our that worries about the world. I think that you can't separate one from another, and I think that historically we have gone for expedience. We have allowed like the concept of externalities to be not even considered. People polluted because that's what governments are. Businesses polluted because they could.
Right, and you can appreciate why I'm asking this question, because when you the compromise of sending your kid to school without a peanut butter sandwich is, you know, it can be rather burdensome. We're all busy. But when we start talking about if the population of the common good is all 6 billion of us, and we're thinking about how to equally share the world's healthcare resources, for instance, and I'm supposed to be happy with 1/6 billionth of the world's healthcare resources, it's not just a minor inconvenience, right? That could be a rather radical reduction in the services available to me. So who belongs in that population is a central problem when we define what the common good is.
Who belongs and who defines the common good?
Right.
Nanette, thanks a lot for joining us on the Socrates Exchange.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, it's the Socrates Exchange today. The question we're pondering this month with you is, are individual rights more important than the common good? Nick, let's take another call. This is Tom in Hudson. Tom, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yeah. Hello. How are you doing?
Fine.
I'm just a regular guy, and to me it's a no-brainer, because if you don't have any common good, I mean, if you don't, they're both important, but if you don't have individual rights, then the common good is never served unless you have somebody at the top that is serving everybody equally and individually. But a lot of times that doesn't happen. A lot of times governments have their own agendas, they get sidetracked, they have their own political power struggles, and the individual gets left behind. I mean, you can look back in history and see that none of this has ever worked, and it's always led to totalitarianism along the way.
Can you say, since I asked the last caller to do the hard work of trying to define what common good might be, If you're emphasizing individual rights a bit more, can you take a swing at explaining or listing what those individual rights actually are? Because we sort of use that term as if it's self-evident that people should have individual rights. What exactly are they?
Well, in general, they're the basic rights to live. And the founding fathers basically spelled out what people usually need. If you go beyond that, then you get special interests. Like, you know, driving a car is not a right. It's a privilege given by the state, and it can be taken away if you don't obey the rule.
Good. If we have a very narrow list, let's say something like life, liberty, and property as the basic individual rights, that's a sort of a common constellation of ones often discussed. Let's just isolate that one life. You know, if we think the right to life is an individual right, does that include the right to food, calories, medicine?
Well, not necessarily, but, you know, people do need food. This can all be...
So we have a right to have food provided to us by a government?
Well, no, it's not necessarily a right. We need it. And these needs drive us to go out and work in society and to get things.
How about if we're disabled?
For survival.
How about for the disabled among us, or those who are elderly or infirm?
It's up to the society as a group to come together as individuals who care to support some of these things, you know, because, you know, not all individuals are focused on that. Some people go down the selfish route, you know, so there has to be a balance. There can't be, but without individual rights, the, you know, if you go towards the common good over individual rights, the individual gets left behind too easily because
you know,
it's somebody else's agenda and not that particular person's agenda.
You know, Tom, a couple of people who posted on our website said what you said. Here's one from someone who called themselves NH Wannabe. Individual liberties are the common good. If you don't believe that, you're in the wrong country or should be working to change the Constitution. And someone else, Anna, said, we need a balance. Our current economic meltdown is the result of individual power and greed with no regard for the common good. So there has to be a balance. Neither can trump the other. The question is, how do we achieve that balance? I want to thank you for joining us on the Socrates Exchange today, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I got to go anyway. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. 1-800-892-NHPR. And Nick Smith, let's go to Earl, calling in from Newfane, Vermont. Hi, Earl. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I thought that one of the best examples of the common good being served was Ken Burns' special on the national parks, where he really laid out how private interests, privileged interests, would go into these beautiful areas out west and places like that and pretty much run amok. When people were able to see what was happening, they worked to set aside these areas for the common good, and it's been something that people have benefited from for well over 100 years now.
Well, Earl, stay up with us. Go ahead,
sure.
Nick Smith.
That is an excellent example. One of the things that libertarians might deny, for instance, that we should have sort of nationally held property like national parks, public held property like national parks, because it requires tax dollars to pay for those sorts of things. But can I ask you, why draw the line at national parks, right? That's a rather small slice of the best property that we have. Why not think of sort of all of our yards as communal property, right? Why sort of carve out just a small couple acre park in your town? Why not think of all of our front and back yards and, in fact, all of our homes and our patios and our kitchens as public property as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I also believe in the private ownership, too. And I think that there does need to be a balance between owning private property and setting aside public land for everyone else.
And that balance seems to be where the issue is.
Right.
Right? And
yep.
Can you say a little bit, where do you draw the line? So, all right, you think national parks are okay, but not, you know, national backyards. Where, you know, where do we, I mean, how about national factories or, mm-hmm. you know, public schools and public supermarkets or, right? I mean, because all of the, you know, all the land that we all walk around could be either public or private, and we tend to err towards private, right? We have this very small set of land carved out as public parks.
I think the people who work to set aside these parks, I think they saw that. But I think, I mean, the system is very heavily skewed towards the private ownership. But I think that they just saw these places as being places that could be ruined by private interests, and they decided to work to set these places aside. I really can't go any deeper into it other than that.
Good. Can you just say a little bit about what if, you know, you often hear the libertarian argument that, you know, I don't really like hiking, camping, I'm never going to go to a national park. Why do you feel the right to take my money to support your leisure activity?
That's a good question. I really don't know. I really can't.
Because we could, you know, you could just charge an admission fee, right? You want to go to the movies, you pay for your ticket. You want to go hiking, you pay your ticket. So instead of the national parks being $20, it should be $200.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and Earl, it's a tough game, okay?
Thank you.
We really appreciate you joining us and jumping in. Good stuff.
Great question.
Thanks a lot, Earl.
Okay.
And up next, Nick, is Lynn from Rochester. She's with us. Go ahead, Lynn.
Yes, I just wanted to point out something that I heard lately that sounded very interesting. I was talking about Jamestown and how they starved that first winter.
Right.
And then they decided that they weren't going to have communal food anymore, that you were only going to be able to eat that which you grew yourself. And then they were fine the following winter. And I think it points out the fact that when too much of it is supplied by the nebulous other, that some people don't feel that they really need to work their hardest. And I'm coming to see the libertarian view more and that it is a republic. And I would like to get, I believe that the group would have make good decisions, but when it gets up into the single people up in the federal level, I see that we need to go back to states' rights and individual rights and individual voting. I think if you have a moral people, then they are interested in supporting and helping people that are helping themselves as well, trying to help themselves.
Great. You make an important point that, in a way, what you're worried is that if we place too much emphasis on the common good, this will sort of undermine our incentive or motivation. So when I asked the previous caller about whether the right to life included a right to food, right, you're picking up on these examples, thinking, well, if we expect to have our food given to us, we'll farm less aggressively and we'll work less hard and all that. Can you respond to the issue? What about those of us who are unable to farm or labor, or you know, a substantial portion of our population is young and old or ill?
We're losing the fact that we're becoming less moral people because we're not finding that we have to help others because the government will do it, or you know, we don't have to worry about it. I think that we need to give. We need to be, you know, we're getting too many people that are becoming a community, a country of takers. Mm-hmm. We need to be givers. We need to nurture that. It's an innate spirit, I believe, to be able to give some. But we don't need to give because they'll be taken care of. We don't have to worry about it.
Can I just ask you, do you trust your fellow Americans to take care of the poor rather than having a government care for the poor? Do you have that sense that we are not so greedy a people that we can take care of our vulnerable?
Real quick, Lynn, what do you think?
I do, and hospitals need not to be for-profits, but need to go back to the non-profits.
Okay. Lynn, thanks a lot. I'm sorry to cut you off there, but thank you very much for joining us. We will take more of your calls after a short break, so stay on the line and keep it right here.
NHPR's fall membership drive begins on October 21st, and you can help us get off to a great start. Make your donation that day and put us closer to reaching our first day challenge. When we raise $60,000 on the first day of the drive, we'll receive an additional $6,000 from a group of dedicated listeners. Don't procrastinate. Make your gift at the beginning of the drive and help us claim that $6,000 to support the news and information you tune in for every day. Mark your calendar for the first day of our fall drive, October 21st. And thanks.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Support comes from UR members in Merrimack County Savings Bank, helping the community thrive for over 142 years with 7 full-service branches in Bow, Kentucky, Concord, and Nashua. TheMerrimack.com. And New Hampshire International Trade Resource Center, helping businesses expand internationally, offering October seminars on export licensing and documentation. Details at exportnh.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the role imports play in our New Hampshire economy and how the current economic downturn has altered the equation. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. You can email us before the program at exchange@nhpr.org in advance, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Now, today it's the Socrates Exchange, and the question we're pondering is, are individual rights more important than the common good? Let's get your thoughts. Call in 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. My co-host for the hour, Nick Smith, assistant professor of philosophy at UNH and project advisor to us here at the Socrates Exchange. And Nick, up next is Rose in Salisbury. Hi, Rose. Go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. What a wonderful topic. I hope my cell phone battery holds up. First of all, I believe rights are inalienable, so I don't believe they're negotiable. However, as people that live in society, we do have to provide for those that can't really provide for themselves due to, you know, age, illness, inadequacies, whatever, you know. I mean, that's what immoral people do. And also there's our government was given the right to tax us for the common good. My problem is that doing it through large bureaucratic governments may not be the best way. However, sometimes I acknowledge that there it might be necessary. I just became aware of the diary of Anna Eliza Young, who was Brigham White's 19th wife. And in addition to that, I become aware of an issue of plural marriages in America where women's rights are being denied. And it's a very touchy thing because it's freedom of religion versus the rights of women to live in a free society and make their own choices. And my understanding is that these are very repressive societies right here in our right in our own United States. I started thinking about this with the large influx of our Muslim brothers and sisters and those who might choose to follow Sharia law, which might go against rights of women.
Well, Rose, and, let me jump in here, and this is great. Stay on the line, and I hope your cell phone hangs in there. Nick Smith.
It's beeping, but I'll listen.
Okay, well, stay with us if you can. Taxation, Nick, we've covered that some, well, but freedom of religion and the common
language, good. The language that you initially used regarding the notion that these individual rights are inalienable, you know, a very fundamental question. If you think human beings have these things we call individual rights, where do they come from? Are they God-given? Or is it something we just kind of made up and stipulate? What are their origins?
I can't tell you, but I can tell you there's a lot more common sense in this than philosophy. And if you just look at human beings and how they would like to live and treat each other and be treated, you might not even need the Ten Commandments. It's a no-brainer. I mean, it really is. I mean, the freedom to choose your own religion, the freedom to say what you think, the freedom to move around. I mean, do we need to say whether it's God or not? It seems just incredibly logical to me that this is the natural order of things.
Right, on the one hand,
but so is living in society. I don't deny we have obligations to each other. I am not saying that.
On the one hand, you do say it seems sort of just common sensical, yet as soon as we start talking about the competing rights in, say, you know, certain faiths may have very different conceptions of what those rights should include. For instance, I have a right to multiple wives, or I have a right to use physical...
You may. And we may see that come up now that the definition of marriage has changed. That's not my problem. My problem is when the rights of women are being ignored and young girls are being pressured into perhaps this kind of situation. That's where the problem is. I could care less if someone has 10 wives, if they're all in agreement on this. But if it's a form of slavery, I'm opposed to it.
And we can notice, right, why the question of where these rights come from, right? If you believe in individual rights, if someone says my individual rights and the suite of individual rights that I enjoy and advocate for come from my holy book, and I think they come from my government or my philosophy, if we disagree on what that set of fundamental rights
Well, then you live in a country where the government that you're living under supports your philosophy. And, you know, and I choose to stay in the United States of America, which is founded on that. If not, there are many places I can go to where I could be comfortable.
You know, Rose, thank you very much. This reminds me, Nick, of the philosophy discussion we had earlier on another Socrates exchange. Are all your beliefs merely opinions, or are there some universal truths? And she's getting at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're closely related because the individual notion of individual rights is so fundamental in how we organize societies and how we understand what our responsibilities to each other are and how we raise our children. And once you pull on them a little bit and you think about, well, why do I have this set of values rather than some other, is it because they're really absolutely universally true that whether it's God or reason has given us this inalienable set of rights that should never be compromised, or whether it's a more sort of socially, historically constructed set of things that we negotiate and evolve over time and, you know, are just sort of relative to culture. Yeah, that really informs how you understand what a government should be, how your family should be structured, and how you should live your life.
Well, Rose, thank you very much for bringing in that element because we hadn't covered that before. Let's go to Portsmouth where Paul is on the air. Hi, Paul, go ahead.
Good morning. Well, this is probably the most contentious philosophical and political issue of every time. But I think if we accept the fact that if an individual is not allowed to flower, then every system has failed. And if charity begins at home, then I think that those individuals who do, in fact, thrive under, shall we say, a libertarian system, they're able to be truly charitable because it comes without a price tag for them, coming from the heart. It's not legislated. And that's always been my huge issue with socialism. And, of course, I lived in Canada for 40 years. My parents come from Europe, and now I've been in the United States. So I've tasted all of these different philosophies. And I can see that in the United States, with all its faults, that the original premise, the original thrust, of society is the right way to go. I think maybe it's going another way now, but I think the cherishing of individual freedom, but not to the extent that you trample on other people's rights, the cherishing of individual freedom is paramount, because if the human being is allowed to express themselves and come to full fruition, then by natural law, but you can call it divine or whatever you want, they will give freely of themselves to other people.
Good. There's this notion in libertarian philosophy that if the government were just to say, get out of the business of healthcare, get out of the business of education, get out of the business of providing social services, that charity would fill in those gaps. So instead of needing public schools paid for by tax dollars, people would be, right, if we were to have no more public schools, charity would do the job that the government once did. Do you have enough faith in people's spirit, people's values, that instead of privileging the educations of their children, so for instance, sending their children to Exeter Academy, instead of, say, taking $20,000 of that tuition and putting it towards the education for their neighbors, child, do you have enough faith in people's sort of goodwill that charity can do the work of educating the populace?
Well, first of all, the family's first responsibility is to nurture their own in the sense that they give them the best opportunity to come to fruition.
And can you say to me why it's not selfish to privilege your children over your neighbor's children? Why is that not just a kind of a bias or selfishness?
Well, for the same reason that it's not selfish to have children. I mean, the fact those children came into your orbit makes you the primary caregiver, makes you the primary responsibility person.
And you don't...
Not the society.
Good. So there is a sense that my people, whether it's my children, my town, my state, my country, come first, right? And that all humans are not basically equal in that respect. And this is the worry, that if we expect charity to do the work of educating our public, feeding our public, caring for our public, that we'll be biased in favoring our children. What can you say a little bit about what motivates or what really informs your belief that we are charitable enough, we are good enough in our hearts in some respect to care for others when we have this overriding bias to protect our own, whether it's our children or our fellow citizens?
Yeah, but even those people who are, like, say, overwhelmed with familial responsibilities, they can have very open hearts, and when they hear suffering, a story of suffering, or they see something, they're affected by it. This is the real measure of their humanity. But their first job is still to take care of their own family, because if you don't, then by default, you're giving it to the state to do that. And that's where the problems are.
Well, Paul, thanks a lot for being with us on the Socrates Exchange. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And next up is Steve in Concord. And go ahead, Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've just been thinking, it seems like people have been social animals since we've been people, and there's always been that kind of tension between balancing individual rights with the rights of the group, or the needs of the group, or the needs of the individual. And it depends on pretty much the cultural heritage you have, how that balance is played out. In the West, we tend a little bit more toward individual rights, although you can't really have a culture, I don't think, that is based solely on that. And in other parts of the world, say some Native American cultures, they have communal housing, they have communal food, and that worked very well for them. But it didn't seem to work well for Western cultures, say in the Soviet Union, when they had collective factories and things, it didn't really seem to work well in with that cultural heritage. You know, and I'm more of a communal rights sort of person. Just for the example that I gave to the screener, schools, if you don't pay for schools somehow, then you don't have an educated public, and so you don't really have anyone who's able to discuss things like individual rights.
Can you, you're making this contrast saying that there's something about our culture that makes us particularly, we emphasize sort of overwhelmingly much individual rights over collective well-being. Can you maybe speculate on why do you think it is that, for example, the United States is so fascinated and so driven by notions of individual rights? What is it about us, right? Because some parts of the world view that as a kind of selfishness, and that the reason that Americans care so much about individual rights is because we're fabulously wealthy, right? Most of the listeners to this program are in the top 1% of the world's wealthiest people. And some will argue that the reason that we're so fascinated with individual rights is that we want to protect our wealth, and we don't want to subsidize the common good, because the common good would mean sort of a reduction in benefits for us, and we'd have to take some of our money to support public health care, public parks, etc. Is it just greed that makes us more, and self-interest that makes us more interested in individual rights, or do you think there's something deeper, more historical, more defensible to that?
Well, I think greed has a lot to do with it. I don't think it's the only impetus to us being interested in individual rights. I think we've seen the way we solved the problem of the state sort of running over individuals. Thinking of the Magna Carta and how, at least the rights of very wealthy individuals in England were protected against the crown. And that sort of led to eventually our own constitution.
So there's some historical roots and philosophical roots and some pure financial roots, too, you seem to be saying, Steve.
Yeah, one interesting caveat to that argument is that many of our notions, what counts as, the individual rights, the notions of life, liberty, and property, for instance, many of those rights we sort of understand as sort of foundational to American history. But Marx is very famous for making the argument that we only start to enforce the rights to life, liberty, and property after we, through violent warfare, take all the property from, for instance, the Native Americans, enslave Africans to do our work for us, and then say that, right, we gain such a wealth and advantage for ourselves that we then make claims that we should protect our wealth with these individual rights.
Steve, I'm going to let you go, and I really appreciate you calling in. Thank you.
Goodbye.
And one more. Let's take David in Ware. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the Socrates Exchange.
Oh, thank you. This is great. I imagine a number of people suggested this topic, and I did also. Back when you were soliciting topics. As I was listening this morning to the radio, to the story about the Piscataquis watershed and how the nitrogen buildup there has been killing off the habitat for the fish, I realized here's just one more example of a story right here in New Hampshire where the individual right to have your septic system fertilize your field around in an area of New Hampshire is impinging on the right of the fisherman or the swimmer or the person living on the bay to have a beautiful environment which can support us with fish and shellfish and so forth. And the government's job is to balance those. And in that case, I think the government can do it in a win-win where we can live around the bay but produce less pollution into the bay by living more carefully, being educated. And we're going to have some laws, some education to make that work. But I think we can do it
here
in New Hampshire.
I think you've sharpened two fundamental issues that I'm glad we're returning to around the issues of environmental common good. Sort of one issue that's really on our radar now is the notion of common good with respect to sort of environmental degradation. And two questions I want to push to you, and you can take them whatever form you like. Who now belongs to this group when we think about the common good? Because if we're talking about all humans, future generations, are we supposed to consider when we protect our watersheds, humans 100, 1,000 years in the future, And are we also supposed to consider the entire global population? Right? It's very easy to think of the common good as my family. But
how
if we include all
it?
Of
right.
humanity, all alive and in perpetuity, how do we narrow
that
group?
That's pretty big. Well, David, and I'm so sorry to do this to you, but I'm going to have to ask you to ponder this a little bit more with Nick on our website, nhpr.org. Okay, go to the Socrates Exchange page. All right?
Be glad to. Let's think of the rights of all creatures, too.
All right.
Indeed.
Thanks a lot, David, for calling in. And again, this conversation continues in a live chat online with Nick Smith on this question, are individual rights more important than the common good, with Nick Smith for the next hour. Right, Nick? You'll be there?
Yes, I will.
All right. And Nick, I want to thank you very much for being on the air with us today.
My pleasure.
That's Nick Smith. Again, he's an assistant professor at UNH, assistant professor of philosophy at UNH, and project advisor to us here on the Socrates Exchange. Now, the next Socrates Exchange is November 24th, and the question will be, has technology helped or hurt us? So again, November 24th, has technology helped or hurt us? That's what we'll be talking about on the next Socrates Exchange. Funding for the Socrates Exchange is made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council and Bank of America. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producer is Dan Ankeles. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.